The East African coastal civilization was distinctive and cosmopolitan, a blend of African and Islamic culture in towns controlled by prominent merchant families. It was an Islamic culture with a very strong secular foundation. And behind this narrow coastal strip, behind mangrove swamps, lay the vast, little-visited African interior, from which gold and ivory and copper cane bought the coast by intermediaries through exchange from community over hundreds of miles. This East African trade generated enormous profits. Why? Because African ivory was much in demand in India. Now, it's a little-known fact that the ivory of the Indian elephant is rather brittle, whereas that of the African elephant is much softer and much more amenable to carving. Carving for the ornaments, which were such an important part of South Asian ritual. At the same time, while this was one of the staple trades, as were textiles from India coming the other way, more prosaic commodities, like mangrove swamps from poles from coastal swamps, were also staple of the trade. So was iron ore. In exchange, coming into Africa for all these tropical products, which included a certain amount of gold, were cheap Indian cloth and particularly glass beads, strings of glass beads, because glass was never made in Africa. And also, the people of the stone towns collected thousands of seashells, cowries, conus shells, from local beaches, and sent strings of these baubles, like the cheap glass beads, for goods worth a fraction of their value of the exports, into the far interior. You see, a glass bead or a seashell had enormous prestige value in the far African interior as a symbol of chiefly authority. As a result, this trade, a dependence between two, developed a symbiosis which was to endure for centuries. Now, much of Kilwa's gold and ivory trade, being off the Tanzanian coast, came from the south, from a place called Sofala, which is south of the mouth of the great Zambezi River. This vast river served as a conduit to a remote and little-known interior, to remote sources of gold and ivory, which lay on the plateau interior over 3,000 feet above sea level, hundreds of miles inland. This, to most people on the coast, was completely unknown territory. But here, occasional trading caravans visited a series of cattle kingdoms founded by Shona-speaking farmers and herders whose ancestors had lived there for many centuries before the first outsiders arrived from the coast in search of gold and ivory. This was cattle country, high altitude, fine pasture land for cattle, plagued a little bit by endemic cattle diseases and by irregular rainfall. But it was sufficient for a series of powerful cattle kingdoms to come into existence on this rolling plateau between the Limpopo River, which is now the northern boundary of South Africa, and the Zambezi River, which is the frontier between Zambia and Zimbabwe, and Mozambique and Zimbabwe. Now, the largest of these kingdoms, at the time when Islam reached the coast, was centered on a valley and a low hill which lay at the head of a defile which brought moisture and cool winds from the distant Indian Ocean. Fogs mantled this hill during the dry season, and inevitably this hill became a center for important rainmaking ceremonies and ancestor cults among the local herding and farming people. You'll recall from much earlier in this course, we talked about the importance of ancestors. Among Shona-speaking peoples in Central Africa, the ancestors really were the guardians of the land. And these cults And the cults of spirit mediums were of enormous importance in establishing a relationship between the people and the land.